This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, the 12th of November, 2020. Hello, and a very warm welcome to you for this week's edition of the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper, where we read extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle. I'm Peter Lydiard, your presenter for today, and I'm joined this week by my wife, Roz.
Hello.
Who will help me read through the various items from this week's Hampshire Chronicle. Our editors this week are Liz and Gordon Legg. First, our regular notices. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings of the Talking Newspaper or the magazine, or if you have a problem with the recording you have received from us, please telephone Liz Legree, 01962 861 229. That's 01962 861 229. Just to remind you, you can use the buttons on your box to move on from an item before it finishes, or back to any of the tracks that you want to listen to again. And if you have any problems with the box which you have been playing the recording on, please make sure you've plugged it into the mains and fully charged it. Now, those of you with computers or tablets, you might like to know that as well as using your memory stick in the box, you can also access the weekly recordings of the Chronicle through our website. That's www.winchestertalkingnews.com. And you can either listen to it off the website, or you can download it to listen to later. Or you can even plug your memory stick into the USB port of your computer. Right, well, the main headlines this week are proposal for a huge 5,000 home town, reaction of horror to proposal for new town south of the city, planners reject garden scheme, and COVID-19 and Winchester. And now Roz will read the next headline. Thank you, Roz.
Yes, this is the headline, proposal for huge 5,000 home town. Proposals to build a huge new town between Winchester and Hursley have been revealed. Royal Down would see the construction of 5,000 new homes, a number that MP Steve Brine said could be seen as an April Fool. The plans for Down Farm, owned by Nick and Susan Russell, also include a new access road, two primary schools, a secondary school, a park and ride, a health centre, and several surrounding solar farms. A new main road would be created to link with Badger Farm Road, close to the entrance to Bushfield Camp, with Hampshire County Council-owned farming estate south of Winchester decimated. Fields would be replaced by employment uses. Much of the land would be planted with trees, including Nan Trodd's Hill, but the land between that hill and Port Lane would be developed. A planning application has not yet been submitted. However, a glossy brochure detailing the developer's intentions for Royal Down Garden Village is available, and a website is to be launched soon. Mr. Brine said, "On first reading, you could well believe this is an April Fool, but it is deadly serious and it must be resisted by Winchester City Council. After Barton Farm, on one side of Winchester, and Pitt Manor right next door to this, there's only so much our landscape setting can take before it is no longer there. We will not build back greener and to protect our environment by concreting over vast swathes of the Hampshire countryside. Working alongside senior colleagues in Parliament, local MPs are doing their bit, but city councils need to join us and back sustainable balanced growth in any local plan afresh. If Royal Down comes to fruition, it will create 3,000 more homes than the Barton Farm development off Andover Road. The proposal came as the government looks to implement a nationwide change to the planning process. local authorities will have to split land into zones, which will be marked for growth renewal or protection. This is to make it easier and quicker for developers looking to build houses. It is currently unclear who is behind the scheme, but James Turner, agent, told the Chronicle, "This scheme has been put forward as there is an ongoing requirement to deliver new homes within the local plan. Royal Down is a new way of building a community, which has been designed with climate change and people's changing lifestyle needs at the heart. Whether this needs to be through the state-of-the-art education facilities or delivering on Winchester's movement strategy, we plan on sharing more detailed information in the coming weeks, which will inform people's opinions on Royal Down and demonstrate that this is a community scheme for the changing way in which people will want to live in the future."
Well, the second headline story is about the same item. It's headed "Reaction of Horror to Proposal for a Huge New Town South of the City." Hampshire County Council and Hursley resident Jan Warwick said that local residents will be shocked when they understand the scale of this proposal. "The housing needs must be demonstrated and brownfield regeneration should come ahead of carpeting over green fields," she said. "These plans will eclipse our downland landscape and the historic village of Hursley. This document makes claims about removing congestion, but this number of houses will impose thousands of additional traffic movements every day on the traffic queues along Badger Farm Road and Poles Lane. I have confidence that our community will pull together and fight these proposals, but we will need our city councillors to play their part too." David Killeen, chairman of Hursley Parish Council, said, "Parish councillors were concerned to hear about these plans. The community should have been consulted first and allowed to input on the amount and type of development in our parish. We understand how we can best protect our historic heritage and rural landscape whilst permitting some necessary housing. We have just completed a parish plan and are now preparing a neighbourhood plan for our area. Royal Down is described as a 21st century garden village. It looks at a mixed tenure of homes and housing types that are affordable, including starter homes, homes for key workers, and adaptable homes allowing families to extend their property. According to the developers, it would enhance the natural environment, providing a green infrastructure network, including zero carbon and energy positive technology to ensure climate resilience." Eleanor Bell, City Councillor for Badger Farm and Oliver's Battery Ward, is also against the new town. "My colleagues and I are strongly opposed to these plans. The proposals are too big, in the wrong place, and will be a disaster for Oliver's Battery and Hursley, and won't work for the Winchester and District either. The sheer size and scale alone are concerning, but because of its location, it is effectively creating an urban sprawl right in the heart of our countryside. It's crazy to be putting another 5,000 houses on this side of Winchester with no serious plan to manage the extra traffic. It's more than twice the number of houses planned for King's Barton. Adding a new road will make the problem worse, not better. It's not the development our area needs. It is too big and destroys our important green spaces. We will fight it all the way." Councillor Jackie Porter, City Council Cabinet Member for Planning, said, "This site was submitted for the council's SHELAR, which is a register of sites that developers want to build, but it definitely doesn't mean that permission follows. The developer is starting to promote this site and talk to local people with warm words. But in reality, local people are extremely angry and fearful of building in this location. The Conservative-backed plans for greenfield sites to be growth areas in their proposals for new-style local plans are adding to this worry.
Planners reject garden scheme. He faced an army of 1,046 objectors, and now the planning battle is over. Ironstone's proposal to build a house on Water Garden near Winchester Cathedral have been refused by the City Council. The plans for the much-loved beauty spot were amongst the most controversial the district has ever seen. A spokesperson for the City of Winchester Trust said a record number of objections clearly shows how strongly city residents feel about the garden. Only one comment supporting the application was received. The application was deemed to fail to comply with a significant number of policies, including the buildings, conservation, archaeology, ecology, flood risk, and tree protection. In a report, a planning officer has listed the reasons for the authority's decision. These include landscape feature makes a positive contribution to the approach to the cathedral, much loved by the residents and admired to visitors. It has a negative impact on a listed asset. The garden was separated from Colebrook House's ownership, so that in effect, it has an effect on the setting of the garden of a listed building. It adds that the house would adversely impact the approach to Cathedral Close, the Cathedral and Wolsey Palace. The full list of 25 reasons can be seen on the City Council's website. Amelia Smithers, daughter of the former MP who created the Water Garden, has written in to object. Her father, Sir Peter Smithers, who served as a Winchester MP between 1950 and 1964, finished the garden in 1962. I was born in 1967 and lived in Colebrook House, Colebrook Street, until I was 7 years old, and my father went to work as Secretary General of the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, France. He begins the objection from Miss Smithers, who currently lives in Switzerland. Even in Strasbourg, my father designed his garden so that it would give pleasure to passers-by. That was the sort of man he was. I remember the Winchester Water Gardens very well, and eventually actually fell into the water of the completed garden when I was 5. I remember the feeling of being fished out and covered in mud. I remembered walking with him in the grounds of the cathedral when he had taken responsibility for planting some new trees. As a great gardener, in planning the Water Garden, he wanted to do something that would give pleasure to passers-by. So he created a garden that was visible from the street. Miss Smithers described her father as great plantsman, and said that he would have chosen the trees, including the magnolia trees, with great care. I believe the proposed construction would largely destroy the gardens and should not be allowed.
And the last of the headline stories is about COVID-19 and Winchester. 38 people are reported to have died of COVID-19 in the last 7 days, according to government figures. The death toll in Hampshire in the 7 days to Tuesday has risen from 777 to 815. In the last 7 days, 1,981 new cases have been reported in the Hampshire County Council area, up to 14,944 since the start of the pandemic in March. The weekly rate for Hampshire is now 148.6 per 100,000 people, compared with 130.2 in the previous 7 days. Figures published by NHS England show that in the last 7 days, 9 people have died in the area covered by the Hampshire Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust that includes the Royal Hampshire County Hospital in Winchester, 13 in Portsmouth, 4 in Southampton. One person has died in the care of Solent and Southern Trusts. So far, 223 people have died with COVID at University Hospital Southampton. At Portsmouth Hospital's NHS Trust, the toll now stands at 262. And at Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, which includes the Royal Hampshire County Hospital in Winchester, there have been 188 recorded deaths. Since the start of the pandemic, there have been a total of 694 deaths across Hampshire, a weekly increase of 28. The discrepancy between the NHS figures and those for local authority areas can be explained through the way the statistics are gathered. Public Health England says it has updated the way it records the location of people who have tested for COVID-19. The number of deaths in the Winchester district has risen from 83 to 90 on Tuesday. Portsmouth, 93, Southampton, 131, and Hampshire, 815, and that includes Winchester. In the Winchester district, the number of cases has grown from 1,818 to 1,492, an increase of 174. But for the change in statistics gathering, the increase would have been higher. The infection rate this week is now 1,194 per 100,000, up from 1,055 since the start of the pandemic. Data shows that the infection rate in Winchester District in the 7 days to November the 12th is 216 cases, or 173 in every 100,000 people. It is now fifth highest in Hampshire after Portsmouth, Havant, Southampton and fast-rising Gosport. Winchester District comprises more than the city and is the city council area, which stretches from Mitchellover in the north to Southwark in the south, from Sparsholt in the west to Bramdean in the east. Meanwhile, more schools have been affected by COVID-19 in the last 7 days, although all remain open. Winnell Primary, Cheriton Primary, King Secondary, Denmead Junior and Perrin Secondary in Oresford have all reported cases. The number of COVID sufferers being admitted to hospital is climbing again. There were 130 on Sunday, up from 97 on Friday, in hospitals across the South East region. On Tuesday, there were 1,071 patients, up from 1,041 on Sunday. 88 are on ventilators, up 5 on Sunday. The latest figure for COVID patients in the Royal Hampshire County Hospital is 57 on Monday, down from 63 last Wednesday. Yes, sobering statistics indeed. Well, a quick rundown of what follows. We start with the death notices, then we have Christian comment, followed by letters to the editor, my Winchester question and answer, Chronicle comment, opinion by George Hayter, Belgarum, what's on, and the lighting up times. So the death notices. Bennett, Diana Mary Bennett, 27th of October, aged 81.
Halpin, Noala Marie Therese Halpin, 2nd of November, aged 88.
Locke, Joyce Edna Locke, 8th of November, aged 100 plus, and she was born on the 20th of March, 1920.
Lovegrove, William Charles Lovegrove, known as Michael, 12th of November.
Monday, Irene May Monday, 1st of November, in her 99th year.
Ward, Jean Amanda Ward, 7th of November, aged 92.
And now we have Christian comment. Thank you, Roz.
Yes, thank you. Christian comment this week is given to us by Rosemary A. Baker. She's entitled it World Kindness Day. Last week, on Friday the 13th, one of my cousins issued a warning on Facebook for us all to take care. I replied that I'll be all right. I was a baker. So why do many people believe that Friday the 13th is unlucky? Both the 13th day and Friday itself are considered unlucky in Western superstition, and both have a long history in this regard. Friday the 13th occurs at least once every year, but can occur up to three times in the same year. Many think that the 13th, is being unlucky, has its origin in the Bible. Judas, who betrayed Jesus, is thought to have been the 13th guest, to sit down at the Last Supper. Even today, it's considered unlucky to have 13 people sitting down at a dinner table, and some people place a teddy bear at the table to make 14. I can remember resorting to a blown-up skeleton. Some hotels don't have 13th floors, and tall buildings avoid having 13th floor, and some airlines don't have a row 13. For hundreds of years, Friday has been considered the unluckiest day of the week. In Britain, it was known as Hangman's Day, because it was usually the day that we condemned to death those who would be hung. On Good Friday, the day of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, is thought to be the only Friday that bucks the trend, becoming a lucky day because it was the day humanity was saved. We can see now how the combination of Friday and the date, the 13th, made for a very unlucky combination indeed. There is even a special word for it, for the fear of it, and I am going to attempt this word, and please forgive me if I don't get it right. The fear of this special word is parascavidicata triophobia. And I'm quite sure that there will be many of you out there who can pronounce it much better than I. And now to continue with Rosemary's Peace. I did discover, however, that there is another Friday that, like Good Friday, also bucks the trend. And what is more, is the 13th as well. This notable day was Friday the 13th of November, and it was World Kindness Day. This is a day celebrated both in this country and in many others. I have, though, been unable to find why this date was chosen, except that it just happened to be the day the International Declaration was signed and so became an annual event. It began in 1998. The aim is for participants to attempt to make the world a better place by celebrating and promoting good deeds and pledging acts of kindness, either as individuals or as organisations. It's actually contagious as well. Recipients feel they want to reciprocate. This year, it coincided with the BBC's Children in Need appeal, which was very fitting. Being kind to oneself as well as others is recognised as being good for everyone's mental health being. We have personally been the recipients of many people's kindness while shielding in the first lockdown and again recently while self-isolating in preparation for my friend's hip replacement. And following the operation, we've been amazed at the offers of help and kindness that we have received. This world can be a happier, better place. And that was written by Rosemary A. Baker.
Thank you, Rods. Well, we now come to letters to the editor. It's a mixed bag of letters this week. Not all of them, you'll be pleased to know, about COVID. For your information, the letters section of the Hampshire Chronicle now runs to four pages, so clearly Winchester residents have a lot to say for themselves. And the first letter is written by Andrea Owen and is headed Wider Afield. Sir, you report that Mr. Brine has told the Prime Minister that there is anger among his constituents that the country is facing another lockdown. And he asked the Prime Minister what we did not do in June and July that we should have done. Well, I am one of his constituents and I am not angry that we are now in a lockdown, but I am appalled that the dithering PM, who, contrary to Mr. Brine's cringing excuses for him, has no excuses this time round, did not act sooner when he received scientific advice in September that the virus would increase and overwhelm the health service if no action was taken. I am appalled that Mr. Johnson's Chancellor was allowed to encourage people to go out together and eat out at the taxpayers' expense, thereby spreading the virus. Johnson has admitted the possibility, whilst at half term there was not enough money in the public purse to ensure that kids from financially disadvantaged families got enough to eat. Mr. Brine voted against providing the necessary funding for the half term holiday. He must now be upset the Prime Minister has changed tack for the Christmas holiday. Or perhaps he's changed his mind too. The Prime Minister's quoted reply to Mr. Brine was disingenuous in the extreme. He thinks that we should have insisted that people isolated when they were contacted. What he doesn't say is that the contact system, world-beating, I believe he described it, has failed to achieve its objectives. Moreover, he has refused to criticise the person he appointed without any attempt to seek the best person for the job through the normal recruitment procedures. If Mr. Brine wishes to make further claims about what his constituents feel, think, believe, he needs to look beyond his own views and those of his immediate circle to the 51% who didn't vote for him and consider carefully the best interests of all his constituents before claiming to speak for them. That was written by Andrea Owen of Culverwell Gardens, Winchester.
This second letter on the subject is headed Lockdown Need, and that's from Donald Black. Sir, we are told that the government follows the science and the advice of the SAGE committee. What the public sees are decisions that seem to be based in wild forecasts by Imperial College and forecasts now called scenarios by SAGE. Perhaps the Cabinet could examine the figures of total deaths in England and Wales as published by the Office of National Statistics on www.1.gov.uk. There was a larger increase in deaths in 2020 versus 29 in March and May, with a huge spike in April. But since then, total deaths were lower in July and August, higher in September by 81 deaths, a day out of a population of 600,000 people. In the latest published figures in October to the 23rd, an increase over the last year was 51 per day. I appreciate that the COVID-19 is a horrible disease, but as is now better understood, it is worth shutting down the economy and ruining livelihoods for a second time when monthly death rates are up to around the norm. And that's Donald Black of Sarum Close, Winchester.
The next letter is written by E. Wright and it's headed School Lunches. Sir, Carly Dez's column, No Such Thing as a Free Lunch, Chronicle November the 12th, struck a chord. During and after World War II, I lived with my latterly disabled father, the two of us existing on minimal national assistance. I was one of only two boys in a grammar school of 1,000 boys who received free school dinners. On one occasion, the head boy was on dinner duty controlling the queue to the canteen and collecting the tickets. When it was my turn, he said, "Ah, so you have free dinners, right?" And as I gave him my bright red ticket to differentiate free dinners from the green tickets that had been bought. That head boy now sits in the House of Lords. During school holidays, I walk some distance to the Salvation Army for my daily meal. There was rationing of just about everything at the time, and basic ingredients were of poor quality, and the meals unappetizing, to the point of being unpalatable. Even so, it was a matter of take it or leave it, and nobody dare waste food in those days. Like Khalid, however, I developed an aversion to some foods like dried egg, gelatine, yellow margarine and stringy parsnips. All this experience conditions my thinking and attitudes to this day. Unlike Khalid, however, I have followed football all my life, and Marcus Rashford is apparently paid £10 million a year. And for what? Educated feet? If he is so concerned about his fellow human beings, surely he could afford a few bob of his own money and buy lots of school meals at about £2 a time? And as Khalid suggests, together with all of Marcus's other obscenely overpaid football mates contributing as well, the issue of free meals will be resolved without resorting to the taxpayer. But don't hold your breath. That was written by E. Wright of Alexandra Road, Chelmsford, Eastleigh.
This next letter comes from Russell Gordon Smith. He says, "Sir, I was very saddened by your column written by Khalid Aziz in the November the 12th edition of the Hampshire Chronicle. He refers to stand-up shouting matches in supermarket and alleges vouchers are welcomed by drug dealers. These comments are based on hearsay, garnered from less trustworthy newspapers, and do not meet even Trumpian standards of journalistic accuracy and truthfulness. His column is a reiteration of the attitude to sturdy beggars identified in the Elizabethan Poor Law of 1531. Those who are fit to work but choose to cadge money to fund their irresponsible lifestyle. Yet just as in those times, there is no work, even for those desperate for employment. The previously well-off, such as BA pilots, who are now happy to drive vans rather than jumbos, we are living through exceptionally hard times. Those on the minimum wage had a struggle before COVID. Small wonder that they have now fallen into the abyss. I never thought that there would be a need for food banks in a well-to-do Alsford, but there's one open now. On another vein, how wonderful to have report, accurate, of a young footballer in the form of Marcus Rashford, acting charitably and with concern for others, learned from his own childhood experiences. Perhaps these consultants in the government who were paid a reported £7,000 a day for our world-beating track and trace system could also chip in to the fund that Khalid Aziz is proposing." And that's from Russell Gordon Smith, City Councillor for Alsford and the Itchen Valley Ward, West Street, Alsford.
This letter is from Roger Mallin, and it's headed Silver Hill. "Sir, once again, Silver Hill is set to be redeveloped, but do we need it now?" Chronicle, November the 12th. "Winchester has evolved for some 2,000 years, and now our current leaders are being expected to make radical changes to the centre in just 25. Perhaps they have failed to notice that Winchester has quietly moved forward successfully during the previous 25 years without this development, and its introduction at the time could critically upset the balance of the city. I think it is fairly well structured, with its different parts efficiently serving our different needs at different times. Hindsight has proved that it was good that the previous scheme was abandoned. Time has shown it would not have been a success. Judging by the vacancy signs, there are already more than enough retail and office units available, so why develop now? And the land is too expensive for housing. If Silver Hill is the city's dirty linen, then it has hidden it with a certain degree of success, and the changes to the bus station and the street market have proved beneficial. At this time, we should be taking little steps. Sort out station approach, the doctor's surgery, and see where we go from there. Perhaps creating an exit from the bus station directly into Silver Hill and improving some of the bland facades in the Broadway. We cannot underestimate the combined effects of COVID and the internet. They have radically altered our habits in work and recreation. Life will never be the same. This is not the time to gamble with the city's development. Let's wait and see what happens in the near future. Now is the time to sit back, relax, and take stock. Don't get obsessed. It's not going anywhere. On a lighter note, there is one thing the city lacks, a red light area. Now, I know it's not a very big area, but it's a thought. But in its right kind of place, and perhaps a couple of antique gas lights could be installed to add atmosphere. Well, that letter is written by Roger Mallin of Goring Field, Takedown, Winchester.
This next letter is entitled Protection, and it's written to the editor by Simon Lever. Sir, the new housing land allocation procedures are so complex, algorithms, that the interpreting areas designated for construction is challenging to say the least, with varied definitions of land types creating further confusion. Chronicle, November the 5th. Parish councils representing the interests of local residents who are highly concerned, the government white paper gives the impression of remote detachment regarding local concerns. Winchester's location offers rural green pastures, woodland hills and rivers, where the case for the preservation of the greenbelt is of increasing importance. Brownfield sites must be evaluated and built on first. However, there must be no redefining of the meaning of green field and green belt and brown field. The Council for the Protection of Rural England is to be positively acknowledged for proposing for a green belt for Southern Hampshire, ultimately to prevent an horrendous urban sprawl. Actually, witnessing the beauty of our region makes it even more crucial to protect greenfield areas. And that's from Simon Lever, Juniper Close, Badger Farm, Winchester.
Hugh Lumby writes, Shop Local. Sir, our retail and leisure hospitality sector right across the Winchester district has had a difficult time during the pandemic. It has been particularly hard for the many independent shops and traders we have, which don't have the firepower and backing of many large chains. They were already under threat from the supermarket chains and online retailers such as Amazon. These small businesses help to bring variety to the city, to our market towns and villages. They help prevent the more urban areas looking like any other town centre. They provide a community focus and a vital lifeline to many residents. It is therefore really important to protect them. Many of these businesses will have benefited from the £28 million or so of government grants provided during the first lockdown. More is to follow this time. But Christmas is a vital time for them, and without a strong trading period then, many may struggle to survive. So, let's all do our bit to support our local businesses now and right up to Christmas. Please do shop locally where you can, including using click and collect services where available. Visit our local pubs and restaurants when they reopen, using their takeaway services during the restrictions. Amazon and the supermarket chains will survive without you. Our wonderful independent traders may not. That was written by Hugh Lumby, who's shadow portfolio holder for the local economy, Upper Meon Valley Ward, Winchester City Council, High Street, Meonstoke.
Safe busking. This is from Marvin B. Naylor. Sir, in response to some negative comments on the local social media regarding me playing at the Buttercross in Winchester today, Saturday, November the 7th, unless someone can suggest a way for me or any other buskers to coax people into our homes, we are unable to work at home. Someone playing the guitar in the street is no different from someone sitting on a bench or walking or cycling, activities we're all allowed to do for however long we wish. Plus, we are, I hope, providing passers-by with some much-needed life relief. That's from Marvin B. Naylor of Greenhill Road, Fulford, Winchester. And he does indeed give us light relief as we pass by.
Thank you. This letter is written by Liz Cooper and it's headed Lighting Up. It's nothing to do with cigarettes, you'll understand. Sir, I would like to thank Winchester Round Table for organising the very special Light Up Winchester firework display on Saturday, November the 7th, which cannot have been easy given the current COVID-19 restrictions. For many of us viewing the firework display over Winchester from St Giles Hill, it raised our spirits to experience a traditional and much-loved celebration which lit up various parts of Winchester. In such difficult and fundraising times for local charities whose services are needed more than ever, I hope the efforts of the Round Table to raise money for good causes is even more successful this year. It's written by Liz Cooper, St Giles Hill, Winchester.
Soul of a pub, writes Nigel Henderson. Sir, I am a frequent visitor to the UK, and before these current troubles, one of the best places I found is the Crown at King Songbourne. They have captured the soul of an English pub. The atmosphere is all-inclusive, the food is excellent, and I hope all is done to keep these important items alive in these difficult times. And that was Nigel Henderson, Montreal, Canada.
Thank you. Now, the last letter appears to be written by somebody purporting to be Peter Lydiard of Parchment Street. I think that must be me. OK, here we are then. It's headed, "The bridge is a danger to pedestrians." Sir, many of your readers will be aware of the danger to pedestrians caused by the narrow pavements on the bridge over the River Itchen at the bottom of the High Street. There has been talk of a pedestrian bridge alongside the current bridge to alleviate this hazard. This illustration, and I'll try and describe the illustration in a minute, shows how this might be accomplished. If the southern pavement is closed and used as part of the road, it would allow the dangerously narrow north pavement to be widened, while the pedestrian bridge would provide a safe river crossing separated from traffic, and even allow space for people to pause and look at the river. Another advantage would be to provide more space at the top of the steps and ramp from the weirs. And while they're at it, a steep ramp should be lengthened to accord with disabled access regulations. Finally, a set of pedestrian traffic lights could be installed, synchronised with the existing pedestrian lights around the corner in Chesil Street to allow safe pedestrian crossing of Bridge Street into Water Lane. Does this seem sensible and doable? That was written by somebody called Peter Lydiard of Parchment Street, Winchester. Oh, and I said I would try and describe the illustration, which shows a curved footbridge separated from the current existing bridge between the Bishop on the Bridge and the Bridge Dental Practice, with barriers to stop people taking shortcuts. Anyway, we'll see what happens. Now, if you have an opinion or a subject which you would like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 86 0836. That's 01962 86 0836. Or you can email them at news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or you can also write with pen and ink to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. Now we move on to My Winchester question and answer. This week they are asked of Simon Hill, a fashion designer turned picture framer and art shop owner of Bramdean, but works at Winchester Framing on Bridge Street. Now Ros will ask the questions and I will pretend to be Simon Hill.
What is your favourite restaurant or cafe?
The Bridge Patisserie. Great coffee and food. Not so great for my waistline.
Oh. So what is your favourite pub or bar?
Oh, it has to be the Black Boy. Though I do love the Cabinet Rooms.
What is your favourite shop?
Well, there are too many wonderful independent shops in Winchester to choose from. But apart from my own shop, Winchester Framing, it has to be the Consortium.
So what is your favourite building?
The Chesil Rectory. It's just so old and beautiful.
What is your favourite view?
The viewpoint of St Giles Hill. Always stunning, no matter what the weather.
Who or what is Winchester's biggest icon?
The cathedral. But a close second is the big issue seller, Kev Colick. He always brings a smile to my face.
Yes. And what is Winchester's best kept secret?
Well, all the fab independent shops, including my own, of course.
Well, so what's the best thing about Winchester?
Ah, the history and the beauty of the place.
And the worst?
Ah, the empty shops on the High Street. I find it very sad that there are so many empty. Winchester is a beautiful place, and it's a shame that all the empty shops let it down. It'd be wonderful to see them all filled with fantastic little independent retailers, which would make the city truly unique.
If there was one thing you could change about Winchester, what would it be?
I'm very passionate about the retail side of the city and making it an amazing place to visit. Not just for the history or a coffee, but a place to spend a full, fun day.
And so, describe Winchester in a sentence.
A fantastic, beautiful, small, unique city, full of character and history.
Thank you very much.
And now we have the Hampshire Chronicle editorial comment from Ros, please.
And he has headed his item, "Lipstick on a pig, but still appalling." The audacity of the Royal Down Garden Village scheme is breathtaking. A 5,000-home new town would be built on farmland between Oliver's Battery and Hursley. To give some idea of the size, Barton Farm stroke Kings Barton is only 2,000 homes. Decades of careful town planning that has preserved Winchester as essentially a cathedral city would be wrecked in an orgy of house building and huge profits for the landowner and developer. A spokesman for the developer told the Chronicle the scheme will demonstrate that this is a community scheme for the changing way in which people will want to live in the future. The glossy brochure talks about country parks, park and ride, solar farms. Dress it up how you like, but it's putting lipstick on a pig. The Chronicle doesn't think that anyone in Winchester would want to live in a city where this one development would increase its population of some 40,000 by around 33%. This is a truly appalling proposal, and the quicker the pig is taken to the slaughter, the better.
Thank you, Ros. Well, now I'm going to read the George Hayter column, and it's headed, "There was no hint of Trump." "Make America great again" was Donald Trump's slogan, but I think that he has made it weaker. He leaves America divided. It no longer leads the free world. His presidency took the land of the free closer to dictatorship than I would have believed possible in my lifetime. And most Chronicle readers agree with me if they take a view similar to the rest of Britain. An opinion poll last week showed that 67% of we British think that Trump's claims of electoral fraud are false. According to the same Guardian poll, 57% of Brits backed Joe Biden in the US election, whereas just 16% supported Trump. I was brought up on American pop music, films and TV programmes. I was excited by the modernity, wealth, skyscrapers and big cars that characterised the huge country. And when I was in my early 20s, I spent several periods saving up for visits to the US. When I got my first chance to live and work in America, I was living in Hampshire, so I thought it would be a neat idea to go to the state of New Hampshire. My student work permit was for 3 months, and American friends encouraged me to apply for a summer job at a hotel they knew in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The hotel didn't want me, and, aged 22, I landed in New York with no job lined up. I had managed to get my work permit through the British University's North America Club. The BUNEC rep at my college told me that the hitchhiking in America was safe, which was true at the time. I hitched 1,700 miles from the Big Apple to Texas in less than 2 days. I never had to wait long for a ride. All American drivers were so friendly. In Houston, I got a job and stayed with John and Ann, a middle-aged American couple who had been our neighbours in New Milton when I was a teenager. They put up with me for 3 months. I managed to get to America again a year later in 1975 when I worked in a restaurant in Charlotte, New Carolina. That time I was put up by 3 households in term. All America seemed so kind. No hint of America first. No hint that a Donald Trump could come president. On my third trip in 1978, I went with a friend, and we enjoyed the same humbling hospitality of the American people, with free rides in their cars, and with some drivers even inviting us to spend the night at their homes. But this time, we were the victims of crime. In Denver, someone stole my backpack from us. The next driver was so appalled that foreign visitors to America had been robbed that he insisted on making good some of the loss by giving me his sleeping bag. In the 1980s, hitching went into decline, even in America. Few drivers gave rides. When I took my girlfriend there in the summer of 1986, a couple who did give us a ride dropped us off near Dover, Delaware. We waited ages for a lift there. Evening turned to night, and then a car stopped for us. It was the woman of the couple who had dropped us there hours before. She invited us to their house to stay the night. She had been unable to settle, worried that we might be stranded on the roadside. You can begin to see why I love America and care deeply about what happens to American people. For 4 years, it has been distressing to see the country come under the spell of reckless Donald Trump, who imperils American democracy by encouraging violence, threatening a political opponent with jail, and defying an election result. It has been particularly upsetting to hear him undermine American journalists with taunts of fake news, when it is he who spreads misinformation. Well, now we move on to Belgarum, who, as you know, gives us an alternative view of the news. Ros, please.
Well, I think this is pretty sensational. It's entitled COVID Doesn't Stop Adventures. Friends who met at Peter Simmons College in the 1960s have completed a mammoth walk, bringing back memories of their gap year. Elizabeth Coates and Penny Allen had respectively returned from working abroad and retired when they both found themselves wanting to go on an adventure. Due to COVID restrictions, the pair were unable to fly off to a far-flung destination. Instead, They laced up their boots and took on the 630-mile southwest coast path, which stretches from Minehead to Southaven Point near Poole. Although they completed some of the walk previously, this time, both aged 62, the women decided they wanted to accomplish the whole route. We know it is demanding, but we just knew our limits. We were very lucky we didn't have injuries, and as time went on, there was a possibility we could just do it all in one. I felt that we were able to do this, and we wanted to do it, Penny said. We were very aware that a lot of our friends couldn't do it because they were not with us anymore or not well. We spent a lot of time thinking about those people. On setting off, the friends said they were unsure as to how they would be received along the route due to social distancing. Elizabeth recalled, "We were relieved there is no lockdown. I was worried whether communities would like us coming through. But people were really appreciative that people were coming and spending time in the southwest." Overall, Elizabeth and Penny completed the walk in 9 weeks and achieved the equivalent of 3, 4, or 4 ascents of Mount Everest. But it was not at all plain sailing. Right as we started, we had Storm Ellen and Storm Francis across the few days. It slowed us down, but we could walk in these situations. We were super careful, said Elizabeth. On other days, they were met with strong winds, which meant they had to change their plans and carry out sections on different days. They have kept in contact since leaving Peter Simmons, and even spent a time travelling together across Europe and Egypt after college.
Well, the second item from Belgarum is headed, "Is this illegally parked?" Questions have arisen after a police speed camera van was believed to be illegally parked on a grassy verge in Winchester. A motorist, who wishes to remain anonymous, spotted the van parked alongside double yellow lines in Worthy Road earlier this month. It is believed that the camera was parked illegally, and he spoke to the person inside, who said they had been parking there for years, catching speeding motorists. He told Belgarum, "I then clearly pointed out that she was parked illegally, and that they are not exempt from parking restrictions, meaning thousands of motorists have been caught speeding by a camera that legally should not have been there." A civilian was said to be inside the vehicle. "The woman was sarcastic towards me and thought the whole situation was funny, as I did not know the law." He added, "Another member of the public joined our discussion and agreed that she should not park there and was breaking the law." Well, clearly breaking the law and making speeding convictions unsafe. This needs to be made public, as it is a disgrace. Hampshire police were contacted for comment, but is yet to respond. In 2015, the driver of a speed camera van in Gloucestershire was fined for obstructing both the pavement and a cycle lane. Well, now we take a look at what's on in the region over the next couple of weeks. Roz, please.
Well, this one is entitled "Not a Panto, but a Christmas Show at the Theatre." Ed Thorpe will be joining Julian Ergley as the second dame in this year's Theatre Royal Winchester Christmas show. This will be Ed's fourth Christmas in the city, having previously played the title role in the last year's Dick Whittington. He also played Wally in Beauty and the Beast and Smee in Peter Pan, for which he was nominated in the Great British Pantomime Awards for Best Song Sheet Award. The casting of the other two dames will be announced shortly. Four Dames in Search of a Panto will be written and directed by James Barry with original music by Simon Slater. Last year, James was nominated for Best Script in Great Britain Pantomime Awards for Dick Whittington and the previous year, together with composer Simon Slater, was nominated for Musical Achievement for Beauty and the Beast. Many awards for Panto, that's amazing. The show will feature piano set pieces, gags and original songs. It is scheduled for December the 5th and will run until Sunday, January the 3rd, with a running time of 75 minutes. In addition to watching the show physically in the theatre, Play to the Crowd will have a live screening of a number of performances. These are also relaxed. British Sign Language and audio described performances are scheduled.
Well, apart from the pantomime, there's plenty of other festive fun for all this coming Christmas. So most of the Christmas events in Winchester have been cancelled due to coronavirus, but still plenty to look forward to, and here's a list of things to get you into the festive spirit. The Nutcracker Trail. The Nutcracker Christmas Trail from November the 14th to January the 4th will see families try to find the 14 Nutcracker Kings in the city centre. Once they've done so, they can enter a draw to win a special prize. And they will look like this. They get hunting. Oh, I see, it refers to a photograph. Okay, which I won't bother to describe to you. Steam illuminations at the Watercress line. Between December the 3rd and January the 2nd, you'll be able to see heritage steam locomotives like never before. Book at the Watercress line. Christmas Mulled Wine Walk. Experience the most magical Christmas city in England with a nice glass of mulled wine from December the 3rd. Meet at the Westgate before seeing the Great Hall, then walk the High Street with its Christmas lights and tree. Soak up the atmosphere with a complimentary glass of mulled wine or hot chocolate as you take a leisurely stroll round the city and take in Winchester Cathedral and other magical sights. You can sign up at walshtours.com. Santa on the Watercress line. You can see Father Christmas in this festive carriage on the Watercress line from December the 5th. Enjoy some traditional festive fun with vintage fairground rides, a delightful miniature railway and a Christmas market. Of course, he won't be allowed to pick up the little ones this year. Christmas with Blake. Come and celebrate Christmas with Blake Christmas, a magical time for friends and family. Blake are inviting you to come along and enjoy an evening full of song and cheer to celebrate the holidays. Take time out of the hustle and bustle of life and relax to the harmonious sounds of this Brit Award-winning trio as they take you on a musical Christmas journey. Book the December the 8th show on the Theatre Royal Winchester website. Spitfire Sisters Christmas Special. Christmas is the Spitfire Sisters' favourite time of year. Performing festive songs, both old and new, with their unmistakable vintage styling and extra mirth a good measure. Bells will be jingled and merriment will be made as they perform a song collection to warm you better than a glass of mulled wine. Book the December the 14th show at the Theatre Royal Winchester website. And last but not least, the Christmas lights. Winchester Business Improvement District is not allowed to tell us when they will be switched on to avoid a big crowd congregating. But rest assured, the High Street will be looking pretty again. And I can assure you that the lights have already been switched on. And for those of you who can see it, they look wonderful. Well, those were the regular features. But before we move on to the general news, I know that many of you are eagerly awaiting for the lighting up times. This week, the sun will rise at about 7:50 a.m. and will set at about 4:45 p.m. Well, on to the items of general news, with Rod starting us off, please.
Yes, I'm going to start with the headline, Man Fighting for His Life After M3 Collision. A man is fighting for his life following a serious incident on the M3 motorway. The incident occurred at 4:06 p.m. on Saturday on the M3 northbound slip road at Junction 11 leading towards Winchester. A man was seriously assaulted on the carriageway and had fled the scene to evade further injury. A 59-year-old man from Southampton was taken to Southampton General Hospital with serious but not life-threatening injuries and has since been discharged after treatment. The suspect, a 21-year-old man from Winchester, was seen on the hatched markings and was subsequently involved in a collision with a vehicle. He was taken to Southampton General with potentially life-threatening injuries. The M3 motorway was closed for several hours to allow officers to investigate the circumstances of the incident and was reopened at around 11:30 p.m. Hundreds of motorists were trapped behind the road closure caused by the incident. One driver, who asked not to be named, said, "We saw the electronic light saying incident, and the next minute on the M3 we saw the traffic tailing back way ahead. We were stuck, not moving an inch for 2¾ hours until about 7:30 p.m. We saw a lot of blue lights from police cars and ambulances coming and going past us. Police officers organised convoy of vehicle from the tailback to the junction 12, but some drivers close to the incident were still motionless at 9 p.m. Tailbacks to Eastleigh were reported. Following the incident, a police spokesperson said, "Officers are keen to speak with anyone who may have information which would have led to the investigation that they began to establish the exact circumstances of the incident." Were you on the M3 at the time? Perhaps you have dashboard footage of the assault or of the vehicle prior to the collision. Anyone with information is asked to phone 101, quoting reference 4420441727. Alternatively, call Crime Stoppers anonymously on 080-555-111.
Majestic ruins revealed again. You can see even more of Bishop's Waltham Palace as work to remove the ivy continues. Contractors for English Heritage have been on site removing the overgrowth. The palace was once home to the Bishop of Winchester and can now be seen in all its glory. A spokesperson for English Heritage said, "Rope access specialists for English Heritage have scaled the 4-storey-high Bishop's Waltham Palace in Hampshire to remove harmful vegetation like ivy, which had obscured the medieval palace and taken root on its ancient walls. Once one of the greatest residences of the richest bishop in medieval England, the palace is just one of the charity's properties undergoing vital conservation work, so the historic places in its care can be enjoyed for generations to come. Bishop's Waltham Palace burned down during the English Civil War, and most of the site has remained a picturesque ruin ever since. The palace was built by Bishop Henry de Blois, brother of King Stephen, and rebuilt by William of Wykeham between 1378 and 1401. Popular with royalty, it was visited by Henry V and also used by Mary Tudor just before her marriage to Philip II at Winchester Cathedral. Henry VIII met Emperor Charles V at the palace in 1522. During the Civil War, that's from 1642 to 1651, the site was occupied by forces loyal to Charles I, but the palace was surrendered to a parliamentarian commander, Major General Sir Thomas Brown, on April the 9th, 1644, after the King's forces were defeated at the Battle of Cheriton nearby. 2 days later, the building burned down. The ruins eventually passed to Admiral Cunningham, later Viscount Cunningham of Hindhope, who was one of Britain's most distinguished naval commanders during the Second World War. He lived at neighbouring Palace House and returned there when on leave, but Prime Minister Winston Churchill ordered a special telephone line be installed to ensure that he could be summoned at short notice. In 1952, Lord Cunningham transferred the ruins to the Ministry of Works, which stabilised the palace and also uncovered several previously buried structures.
This next item is the story of a boy who became Chancellor. A new biography of former Winchester College student Rishi Sunak paints a picture of a popular sports-mad child in Southampton. Going for Broke, The Rise of Rishi Sunak by Michael Ashcroft quotes neighbours and friends who knew the future Chancellor as a saints-mad boy with lovely manners. Rishi Sunak was born in Southampton General Hospital on May the 12th, 1989. I'll read that again. He was born in Southampton General Hospital on May the 12th, 1980. I apologise for that. His mother, Usha, worked as manager of Western Pharmacy at the time, while father, Yashir, was GP, whose surgery was on Richmond Road, Shirley. The family lived at Richmond Gardens in Portsmouth, but moved to Spindlewood Close, Bassett, after the birth of their second son, Sanjay, and the daughter, Rashgil. Lord Ashcroft, a former Conservative Party chairman, writes, "People on Spindlewood Close still remember the small boy with black hair, a ready smile and lovely manners, who used to wheel around on a bike with other kids or kick a ball about with his little brother, Sanjay." Neighbour Jane Parnell, recalls, "The whole Sunak family, including the children, were very friendly, very personable." Rishi Sunak went to the Southampton Prep School, Oakmount, until it closed in 1989, then to Stroud School. Fellow Stroud pupil, Ollie Cast, who went on to be a teacher there, says the teachers could say he is going to be a Prime Minister. The book says young Rishi captained the Stroud cricket team and took part in football, hockey and athletics. He was head boy in his final year. The Sunak family celebrated special occasions at Cootie's Brasserie in the city and would dine there every Christmas Eve. Dr. Sunak had a season ticket to watch Southampton Football Club, and the future Chancellor's childhood hero was Matt Letissier. Rishi became a boarder in Winchester College, where it seems the naughtiest thing Sunak ever did was to smuggle a handheld television into the school so that he did not miss the key games of Euro 96. For his 18th birthday, he received a card signed by the Saints squad, which became one of his most prized possessions. Southampton would always be home, and this would always be his team, Lord Ashcroft writes. Rishi Sunak went to Oxford University and received a Master's in Business Administration at Stanford University in the US. He became wealthy as a hedge manager and married Ashikata Murthy, the daughter of an Indian billionaire, before becoming MP for Richmond in Yorkshire in 2015.
Deal struck for new care home scheme. A Winchester charity has struck a deal with a developer for its new 60-bed care home. The Brendan Care Foundation is set to build the facility in Quarry Road near St Giles Hill. It will be developed by Octopus Real Estate's in-house healthcare team and is due to open in the spring of 2022. It already has planning permission. Marion Wanstall, chief executive at Brendan Care, said, "We are absolutely thrilled that the deal has been completed and we will be working with Octopus Real Estate on this exciting project. The new home will provide much-needed support for older people in Winchester, offering nursing, dementia, residential, respite and end-of-life care. The community spaces will be invaluable for us to be able to offer services to local people, helping to prevent social isolation and loneliness. We will also be providing community support services for people who may need extra help to enable them to continue to live independently in their own home. The home will be called St Giles View and has been custom designed for Brendan Kerr, who will lease the building. All 60 bedrooms will have an ensuite. There will be a cafe and restaurant, a hair and beauty salon and community spaces. Ed Clough, Director of Care Homes at Octopus Real Estate, commented, "We're delighted to be developing and funding this new best-in-class care home for Brendan Kerr. It is an exciting project which pulls together the specialist development and investment expertise within Octopus Real Estate and will deliver a high-quality care home for the local community in Winchester. We have worked closely with Brendan Kerr to make sure the home is designed to a high standard, meeting their bespoke requirements. Brendan Kerr's knowledge of the local area has been invaluable, and we hope to work together on future new homes too."
Well, this next item is exciting. I'm very pleased to be able to read it. Hit Netflix series The Crown returned to our screens this weekend, and eagle-eyed viewers might notice a familiar location. Two scenes of the fourth instalment of the award-winning show were filmed at Winchester Cathedral in January. Charles and Diana's wedding and Lord Mountbatten's funeral were both filmed at the cathedral, respectively transformed into St Paul's Cathedral and Westminster Abbey. During filming, Helena Bonham Carter was seen in costume as the grieving Margaret, and Olivia Colman, who plays Elizabeth, was spotted in the cathedral close. Emma Corrin, in full makeup to look like Diana, was also pictured walking round the back of the cathedral. The show last came to Winchester in 2018, taking over the Guildhall, and also shot several scenes of the early shows in the Winchester College area around the Wickham Arms in 2016, January. This time, crews set up cherry pickers to shine lights through the cathedral windows to make it seem like summertime. Lord Mountbatten's funeral was held on a sunny day in September in 1970, after he was killed by a bomb hidden on his fishing boat in Ireland. Charles and Diana also married on a hot day in July 1981.
Tribute to much-loved ex-mayor. Jean Hamerton, ex-mayor of Winchester, died peacefully at her home in Bishop's Waltham on October the 14th, aged 90. Jean was much loved and respected for her common sense and humour, a lady who started her life story with, "I was born in Hastings, not long after 1066. Growing up during the Second World War, Jean left Bournemouth School for Girls to become a student pathologist at Boscombe Hospital, just as the NHS came into being. Almost trained, her medical hopes were stymied by TB, in those days a serious illness involving a year-long hospital stay and 18 months outpatient treatment, not the best for a lively 20-year-old. After a summer on Bournemouth Beach selling buckets and spades but unable to return to pathology, Jean found employment in a private clinic. From then on, Jean moved on in medical settings, including old Bishop Waltham surgery, where, as receptionist, her office was an ex-cupboard. When the surgery moved to larger premises in 1979, Jean became practice manager. According to Dr. Paul Hemming, she had a natural instinct for the way ahead, developing not only an efficient organisation but managing the rapidly enlarging staff in a warm and friendly atmosphere. Ever sympathetic to patients' needs, Jean solved problems calmly, promptly and positively. After leaving the surgery in 1993, Jean continued her medical interest as a director of NHS Mid-Hants Primary Care Trust, notably in Bishop Waltham. David Williamson recalled an amazing encourager as he initiated Heart Start and first responders, and she served for 17 years as Heart Start's chairman. Her commitment to helping people continued with long-running roles as chairman of the local Citizens Advice Bureau and president of Friends in Retirement. In Winchester, Jean was well known for her service to local government. During the 1970s, she took her first political steps by becoming a Bishop Waltham parish councillor, progressing to chairman in 1986. Finding that the parish councillor constantly referred to Winchester City Council, Jean then resolved to stand for district election in 1994. Temporarily manager in a university practice, her request for time off to campaign was met with a horrified, "You can have the time off, but you better win," to which Jean replied, "Well, it's a bit of a joke because I'm standing as an independent." Nevertheless, Jean was popular and trusted in the community, so she sailed onto Winchester City Council. For 10 years, Jean brought her trademark common sense to bear on many important district issues. Jean said that she was utterly, utterly amazed to be honoured as Mayor of Winchester in the 2003-2004. She approached the year, which she described as exceedingly interesting, with her unassuming blend of tact, practicality and friendliness.
Infections on the rise among police officers. More than 800 police officers in the UK have tested positive for COVID-19 since the pandemic began, figures show. Data obtained through freedom of information requests by the PA News Agency's radar service show 849 officers across 24 of the UK's 45 forces have tested positive for virus. The Police Federation and officers across the country are in constant worry when faced with offenders who may spit, bite and cough while being dealt with. The figure includes 229 officers from Police Scotland, 101 from West Midlands Police and 95 from the Greater Manchester Police. At Merseyside Police, where Chief Constable Andy Cooks has tested positive in March, 62 officers have contracted the virus. The figures do not include the Metropolitan Police, which is yet to respond to the FOI request submitted in September, and the 20 forces who did not provide the information. Forces that responded did so between October the 6th and November the 6th, so case numbers could be higher. In August, the National Police Chiefs Council and College of Policing issued a new guidance to forces for use of personal protective equipment. Advice was also given on social distancing, but it was accepted that maintaining a 2 metre distance was not always possible. John Apter, chairman of the Police Federation, said it was inevitable that some officers would catch the virus given the nature of their work. He added, as well as the danger of contracting the virus, policing the pandemic was also taking a toll on mental health and well-being of officers as they continue to work 12-hour shifts and have rest days cancelled to help protect the public at this difficult time. There is also the constant worry of bringing the virus home to their loved ones, which is exacerbated when they deal with offenders who weaponise the virus by spitting, biting and coughing, which is disgusting and unacceptable. Police need to realise that behind the uniform, officers are mothers, fathers, sons and daughters. Mr. Apter urged the public not to give up now on suppressing the virus and to follow the latest guidelines to reduce it instead, and the National Police Chiefs Council also urged the public to follow regulations. Chairman Martin Hewitt said, While demand levels remained high, we are well prepared to respond to any crime or other issues that arise. Aside from the 24 police forces that responded, Durham Constabulary said 37 police had been absent due to COVID-19, while Wiltshire Police said 131 officers had reported COVID-19-related sicknesses.
Leader, all talk and no trousers. Things got heated when an opposition city councillor accused the city's Liberal Democrat administration of working behind closed doors. At a recent cabinet meeting, Conservative councillor Linda Gemmell questioned the council leader's transparency. A debate ensued, with councillor Gemmell saying the leader, Lucille Thompson, was all talk and no trousers. The Mayor of Winchester, Councillor Patrick Cunningham, had to step in to end the discussion. Councillor Gemmell, who represents the central Mearn Valley, initially asked, "Considering the paucity of the full council agenda in the past year, you can tell me what exactly has gone on behind closed doors that has not been brought forward for full council, and when we will be able to see it." Councillor Thompson replied, "We were given the option of cancelling the meeting, but we felt that it was really important to allow members of the public and councillors to put their questions to the administration. There was no decisions made behind closed doors. I would have thought that the large number of additional cabinet meetings we have slotted in to the calendar, taking decisions on a variety of issues, CIL spending programme, the Voltex site, the Barin depot, our response to the government's proposed changes to the planning system, amongst other things, all online and all in public, clearly demonstrates that this is not the case." Councillor Gemmell thanked the leader for her response. But things quickly turned sour when she added, "Where's the transparency? You're all talk and no trousers." "I don't know how much more transparent we can be. What do you expect?" responded Councillor Thompson. "All meetings are held online and we encourage all members and the public to take part."
MPs urged to back NHS workers' pay. Hundreds of health workers in the South East are urging their MPs to back an early pay rise for staff and to protect the NHS. Nurses, paramedics, cleaners, domestics and porters are writing to the region's 84 MPs, asking them to support the union's call for the NHS staff to get an early pay rise in time for Christmas. Staff employed in hospitals, clinics and ambulance stations across the regions are urging politicians to put their case to the government for a significant pay rise of at least £2,000 for every worker across the NHS. The next NHS pay rise is due in April, but the staff are claiming that bringing the increase forward would help staff feel more valued as the second wave of the coronavirus pandemic surges. Excuse me. Unison South East Regional Secretary Steve Torrance said, "Health workers are exhausted from the first virus peak. They are now dealing with the second wave and a backing of cancelled treatments. Now is the time for a significant pay rise from the government. Workers doing the job would feel even more valued, and to increase, and an increase could attract much needed new recruits." Unison says the pandemic has affected staff and may choose to leave the NHS. Such are the levels of exhaustion. The union added that raising pay this year could persuade staff to change their minds and make the NHS more attractive to thousands of recruits.
Well, that concludes the Hampshire Chronicle extracts for this week. Just another reminder that Liz Legree is the person to call if you have any problems with your recording. Her number again is 01962 861 229. Many thanks to our copying and dispatch and memory stick preparation teams, and to our editors, Liz and Gordon Legg. And of course, many thanks to Roz for joining me in presenting the Hampshire Chronicle this week. When you finish listening to the recording, please put the memory stick in the yellow envelope, also putting your address label inside the envelope and pop it in the post, no stamp required. The address label to ensure that it is returned to us at our new address in Twyford, so thank you. So it's goodbye from Roz.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Lydiard. Goodbye.